Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. Classic book adaptations such as Far From the Madding Crowd and Don't Look Now. Modern just-off-the-radar favourites, including The Kings of Summer and Take This Waltz. What about some flat-out masterpieces such as Peeping Tom and The Servant? We're going to do our very best to explore them in this podcast. I've got another really special episode for you this time, with another really special guest. To join in the 40th birthday celebrations for the immortal Highlander, I've been in conversation with its director, Russell Mulcahy. You'll be able to hear my chat with Russell just after this taste of the film.
This cannot be. It's the devil's work.
You cannot die, MacLeod.
Accepted. I hate you.
Good. That is a perfect way to start.
A very warm welcome then to the Studio Canal Presents podcast to the director of Highlander, Russell Mulcahy. And I think I've got away with pronouncing your name okay there, Russell. How are you? How do we find you?
I'm good. Thank you. Good to be here.
I mean, the key question I've had reading a lot of the behind the scenes things on Highlander is, what on earth was Sean Connery's homemade scotch like?
I remember when I got on a plane, we were going up from London to Scotland to shoot the Suffolk Glencoe. And he brought out a little bottle and he said, "Hey, laddie, now this is a special brew." And he gave me a little wee drammer of it, and it knocked my socks off. It was, I mean, it must have been 200% proof. So I don't know what it was, but it was, I was happy all that flight.
Did he travel on flights with basically homebrew in his hand luggage?
Yeah. Fantastic.
I mean, I trust he didn't make it himself, that someone else was making it for him. I just...
No questions were asked. I mean, it was Sean Connery. It was 007. What can I say?
I mean, we're chatting here at my local multiplex up the road, and I'm in the West Midlands here in the UK. Has Highlander on all over the weekend? Screenings of Highlander 40 years on. And I mean, it's such a boring, obvious question to ask you, but I just wonder if you can kind of capture just what that's like for a piece of work that was packed into a period of your life to still be the one that you're being asked questions about, presumably for the 15th time today.
Yeah, listen, I wasn't even sure I'd last 40 years, let alone the film. But I guess it's found its audience over time, and it refuses to die. It's quite heartwarming to feel that something has lasted that long and actually seems to have a life.
Is there a little bit of the pop singer who's got one song that everyone talks about, and then you go off it halfway through your career, and then like a little bit later on you warm back to it? Have you always had...
Well, yeah, I mean, I think when I did Highlander, when it was first released in the States, I think Fox tried to kill it as best they could, and it lasted like... 4 days in the cinema with the most atrocious reviews. And, you know, I thought, you know, that's the end of my film career and I'll just stick to making music videos, which is fine. So who knew at that point? I thought it was all over.
Did you genuinely think it was a career ender then? Was it?
Have you read the reviews?
Yeah. Yeah, I know where you're coming from. I'm just like the initial response.
I mean, I'm talking about the American reviews. They were brutal.
Yeah.
You know, Mulcahy throws in the kitchen sink and this and that, blah, blah, blah. It's just a long music video and... whatever. But then it premiered in Paris, and I went to the Parisian screening, and it was the most extraordinary event. And I went, oh, wow, the audience actually quite like it. And so that sort of lifted my spirits a little.
I mean, to acknowledge, the version of you that made this film was younger than the film is now. I was just trying to wrap my head around that.
Yeah, I was, what, 33?
33. It's your second narrative feature. And I'm just curious, when it is kicked around to that level... because you're still a human being in the midst of it all.
Right.
You're still reading all of this. And then presumably you're flown over to Paris knowing what's happened in America. Is it almost like with a sinking heart you walk into a screening like that?
It was, but then, but on the way from the airport and going into Paris, all of a sudden they had these gigantic 40-foot cutout statues of Sean Connery and Christopher Lambert all down the Champs-Élysées. Boom, boom, boom. And I went, what the hell? It was like, the Yellow Brick Road. It was like, what the hell's going on here? And then the audience reaction that evening was just emoting all the way through the film in a positive way. Yeah, it was a real come to Jesus moment.
That's lovely though, especially when you've been kicked around so much to
Yeah.
be in something there, and it sounds like a straight 180, really.
It was, yeah, 360. Yeah, it was absolutely.
Because I've heard you talk about that before, just that drive and seeing those massive cutouts. So
And with no forewarning, and you turn a corner, all of a sudden,
that's the bit I kind of wanted to drill into, really, that you had no
no idea.
idea. It's staggering.
I'm going off to a screening, and all of a sudden, I'm presented with that. I was like, oh, looks like an event.
And so the Russell Mulcahy who walks out of that screening, is it a case of you're returning three phone calls, otherwise you wouldn't have returned? Is it just a fresh boost to try and get projects off the ground?
No, I did that, and I think I then went back to London and started doing a few more music videos.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like, oh, I better get back to Hollywood quickly. I was never into that so much. But no, it was good. It was just a personal, and but not only for me, but also for the cast and the crew that had worked so bloody hard on this film. It wasn't just me, I promise you. Everyone was there in the trenches on this movie.
That's important to you as well, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Whenever I read interviews that you've done, not just on this film, but on many others as well, you always seem to go out of your way to name check people in the crew.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you got Alan Cameron, Jim Acheson, and Peter Hoeness, and Jerry Fisher, and everyone who worked on the crew was just extraordinary. And then our cast. I mean, the film was a certain way organized chaos because we didn't really have the budget or the technology. So a lot of it was done with smoky mirrors and string and sticks, and very much a sort of a rock and roll fantasy. In the way it was shot. I remember on day one with Jerry Fisher, a wonderful DP, but we're a very traditional DP. And I think the first day, a lot of like bounce boards and this and that were coming in and da, 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 and it was like, I felt very claustrophobic. And so we got to the car park scene. I said, Jerry, why don't we just not do that? Let's just have the fluoros on and then we'll just have them flash on and on. And we'll just go a little crazy. And he went, oh, he was very. Wasn't too into it. But then after day one, he saw the rushes and he went, oh, that sort of works, doesn't it? And then he just came to the party full slog and just really let his hair down, so to speak. It was wonderful.
Again, in terms of minor turning points, those rushes, had they not gone your way, we'd be looking at a very different film, presumably. But you must have had an instinct
I
that,
knew it was going to work, yeah.
yeah.
I wanted to break some rules, you know, because we just had to, you know. It was like, I had to lean into style because we didn't have much else to go with.
What's your ultimate background, Russell? Is it because I read theatre somewhere. I know you did an enormous number of music videos, but if we dig even further back than that, what was the spark?
Well, it was a combination of like making little 8 mil movies myself and cutting them together but also I did a lot of acting and on stage, and I was very into stage productions and design, and I love theatre.
Yeah, and do you still love theatre to this day? Is that still?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, so it was a mixture of that, and also just very much growing up in the cinema too, with watching a whole anything from Ray Harryhausen movies to Fellini to Ingmar Bergman to Fred Astaire
Yeah.
musicals, and so my taste was so varied, but so concentrated in a way, very sort of stylized type of movies.
There's the old phrase, the old cliche of what you watch when your portal is at your most open, which I've heard a few times recently. And presumably that's what you were watching, everything from Harryhausen to Fellini to Fred Astaire. That explains a lot. That explains a lot. But I mean, I'm curious because a film you're not asked about an awful lot, but it strikes me as it's really pivotal to Highlander is Razorback, the first time you're directing a narrative feature film yourself. And I just wonder, for those unfamiliar with the film, can you just tell us a little about that and what you learnt from making your first narrative feature?
Yeah, it was like, I remember the first day, I got there about 2 hours before call. It was way out in the outback and the sun hadn't even come up yet. And I went and sat on this hill and quite nervous, thinking, what am I doing?
Yeah.
And then I just jumped into it and it just evolved. And again, surrounded by a wonderful crew who supported me. Yeah, that was a hell of a jump from I got that film from basically a music video. I think Hal McElroy saw Hungry Like a Wolf, a Duran Duran video, and I'm in London, and he calls me up and said, "I just saw Hungry Like a Wolf. Do you want to come and do a movie?" And of course, I want to do a movie. I mean, I've been cropping all my videos to like 185 or 233 because I was desperate to do a movie. But all of a sudden, this guy calls me up, says, "Do you want to come and do a movie?" I say, "Absolutely." "What's it about?" He said, "Oh, it's about a killer pig." And I went, "Terrific!" And off I went. And I think you can still see a lot of the music video style in that movie, to the point where when it was first released in Australia, a lot of people were very upset because, it was some of the attitude of Australia wasn't depicted in the most positive way. So, yeah, I wasn't quite exiled, but it was like, oh.
It's no coincidence your next film was not made there.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, because we've touched on music videos a little, but one of the contrasts that strikes me is, for those unfamiliar, your music video career is absolutely extensive. But I read an interview where someone was talking about when you were working on music videos, you had far more resources than you did when you were working on a feature film, that you're at the higher budget end of a lot of music videos, but the lower budget end of filmmaking. Is that a fair kind of contrast, really?
I guess in contrast, for example, if you show something like Duran Duran Wild Boys, that is an extraordinarily expensive set for a 4-minute piece of film, to the point where Sting was shooting The Bride next door at Shepparton. Yeah, and Sting came in, and Simon's spinning around the
On the
windmill,
windmill.
and he went, "Wow, look at this set." I mean, he said, "It's bigger than my set." And it was. I mean, yeah, so in contrast, the amount of money that was spent on that film compared to the, yeah, it was extraordinary.
But the late great Tony Scott used to get quite a lot of press for when he'd give an interview and talk about he's doing a music video because he's trialing something that he's going to use in a feature film.
That's true. That's true.
And by the sounds of it, you were about 10 years ahead of him on that, by the sounds of it.
I used to hang out with Tony in London, and I think I'd just done Razorback, and he'd just done The Hunger. And he's sitting there, and we're both sort of depressed because both films are sort of like flopped or whatever. And he says, "Oh my God, my first one, I do a bloody vampire," and said, "I do a killer pig." And it's like, wait. Of course, then Tony goes off and does Top Gun. God bless. I'm totally a wonderful man, but I remember that morning, both sitting in his office, like depressed, lamenting on our last, first films.
So coming to Highlander, I mean, you've told this story a fair bit about being on the set at Shepparton shooting Wild Boys. You've got Sting next door,
and I met Clancy Brown.
And Clancy Brown, yeah, and Clancy.
Yeah, but at that point, I didn't know about Highlander. But it was quite, quite fortuitous. I met Clancy, an extraordinary young actor. So when it came around to the casting, it was like, "Oh, hang on, I remember this guy. How about Clancy?" Yeah, so that was, it all sort of folded in. It was amazing.
The production of Highlander, I mean, the story went that the producers were just trying to get the money together for several years before they could get it off the ground. How far into the process do you get the phone call? Is it pretty much ready to go?
I think because a lot of the finance came from EMI, who actually had Duran Duran, and they saw the Wild Boys video, and it wasn't until they saw, I think they saw that video during the shooting of it or whatever, that they rang me up and said, "We want you to go and meet the producers, and here's the script." And I read the script, and I went, "Oh my God, this is so brilliant!" Had a very good meeting with them in London. Very quick meeting. Seriously, the meeting was probably like 15 minutes. It was like, "Yeah, I really want to do this. Fantastic rock and roll, magic, romance, fantasy," and off to the races we went. Yeah, it was not like an intense. Yeah, it was like,
15 minutes.
yeah, it was bizarre. I was like, "Oh, I think I've just got a movie." Right, okay. I know that very rarely happened.
I was going to say, what's the second shortest meeting you've had to get
Yeah.
a film? I'm genuinely curious by way of contrast.
Probably Razorback, when the guy called me up and said, "Do you want to come and do a movie?" I went, "Okay." So yeah. The meet, I promise you, the meetings are getting longer now.
I was going to say your introduction to feature film directing was two meetings that didn't take more than an hour between them to set your level of expectation going
Yeah,
forward.
now I mean, is if you go see a studio, your agent will call up and say, "How long was the meeting?" You say 30 minutes. "Oh, that's not good." "How long was the meeting?" "Oh, 55 minutes." "Oh, that's pretty good." It's like the algorithm of meetings. It's like,
Is that right? Heck.
yes, it is with casting everything. It's all done with algorithms now of like who's what worth and da 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 whatever. Yeah.
Well, it's the whole algorithm of filmmaking at the moment as
The
well.
original Highlander, you couldn't do that now. Like Christopher Lambert, who was really unknown, Clancy Brown, who was really unknown,
Yeah.
and we had Sean Connery, boom. So, but now you need three stars.
But even Sean Connery at that point wasn't. I mean, what had he done? Just come off Never Say Never Again?
His career was in maybe a bit of a lull. Yeah, you're right. But we were so lucky with our casting.
Yeah.
We had Sean,
Yeah.
and I remember sitting in an office one day in LA with the producers, and we're going, well, who's going to play Christoph Lambert? And they brought out the regular list of 10 actors and go, yeah, okay, yeah. And I'm flipping through a magazine, and I see a photograph of Christoph Lambert from Greystoke, this close up. I look at this face,
Yeah.
and I said, this is the guy.
Yeah.
And they all went, oh my God, who is it? And he was cast. He just had this magnetic look. He had this look of an immortal. Just something just screamed to me.
I wonder if that's a bit of the music video director in there,
Yeah.
knowing precisely the image you need to, it's just
I
like.
don't know what it was, but I remember that morning very specifically and how it actually magically just worked like that. And then Kurgan was like, oh, I met this guy on the set of the Wild Boys, this guy Clancy, and they went, oh yeah, he's good.
The terrifying one in your cast list, to my eyes, from the outside looking in, would be Sean Connery as a 30-something director. And Sean Connery had a reputation, really, for not suffering fools gladly. I think I can say that. I'm just curious what your were. I mean, clearly it ended up with a beverage or two, so it couldn't have been too bad.
I wasn't terrified about being intimidated because, listen, I worked with the Stones and been strangled by Keith Richards and, so I've dealt with all that shit. No, listen, when I went into the Savoy Hotel to meet him for the first time, and I go up to the door to knock on the door, and I'm nervous because I'm about to meet 007. I grew up with this man as James Bond, I promise you, from Doctor Do all the way through.
Yeah.
So I knock, and he opened the door,
Yeah.
and there was this legend, like. But then he was just so gracious, so regular, so normal. And we sat down and had a cup of tea and some sandwiches, and we got on like a house on fire. Yeah. I think he saw that I was sort of pissing myself. He meant, and he was very much like, come on, laddie. In some ways, he took me under his wing. And it's like, yeah, he was very cool.
I love that. And you had him, what, for 5 days?
7 days.
7 days on the shoot in the end.
That included the London shoot in the forge where he gets killed. And then we flew to Scotland, and we just shot manic, just Sean, and even to the point where we'd shoot close-ups of Sean over Chris's shoulder, and then we'd have to come back weeks later and shoot Chris's close-up over a double of Sean, because we didn't have time to do the full coverage, which was basically just get Sean Connery on film. That was the objective.
So is the story true that in the last,
Uh-oh.
no, it's not a scurrilous one, don't worry. Is the story true that in the last half hour you had with Sean Connery, he thought you weren't going to get everything and you just put three cameras on him and
Yeah,
shot?
it had three cameras. We're looking at our watch, and he said to me, he said, if we go over, he'll get paid an extra like $250,000 or something. He was like, or whatever he's going to get. And so it was like, three cameras. And he said, you're not going to finish. You're not going to finish with me, laddie. You're not going to finish. I went, okay. Da-da-da. And we threw hats on him and this and that, and turned left, right, give him a sword quick. Da-da-da, do this. Now look this way. Now laugh. Do a swipe, whatever. Just ran through a whole lot of stuff real quick. And looking at my watch, and just before it reached 7, I went, and cut, that's a wrap on Sean. And he looked at me and said, you bastard. Of
With a big grin on his face, presumably.
course, of course.
Yeah. Going back to that script that you received, there was an interview Tarantino gave donkeys ago where he said he's going to make a finite number of films. So he wants to basically do as many as possible in each film. And you talked about what you saw in the Highlander script, this sweeping epic, this romance, just in terms of even putting the story aside, what was the amount of cinematic genre? You get to tackle in one film. Have you come up against anything quite like this before? Was it really a kind of eureka moment?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, it was like, how often do you get to go from like modern day back to Scotland and do these wonderful transitions and have World War II and then some 18th century France or whatever? It was a wonderful tapestry of collage of images, and it was really important for me to get a grip on the transitions from the periods. I wanted the audience to not to be jarred into a period, into the transition. I wanted them to basically to go with the flow, to be emoted into it, you know. And that had to do with both the visuals and Michael Kamen's score or whatever it was. But something that would and you know, the transitions were, most of them were all worked out, and some were worked out in reverse, like the one in from him in Scotland to the painting on the wall. That one actually came out by complete mistake, by accident. We were filming in New York, and I saw that Steppenwolf thing on the wall. We filmed it, and I went, "Hang on, let's just run back. When we go back to England, we'll shoot Chris's close-up against an old rock or something." And that one worked in reverse, and it worked really well. So the transitions were important to me.
I dread to think what your life was like 3, 4 weeks beforehand, planning and pre-visualizing everything. I mean, just in terms of building up to day one, was that as tense as it got for you?
Listen, I mean, a lot of it was pre-planned. A lot of it was just like, let's get all this shit together here, and it was sort of a little organized chaos, a little madness. The only way it could happen was that certain madness that was calculated, but you lit the fuse and see how it went.
There was also an element that I saw of kind of a guerrilla with a you filmmaker to this, in that, I mean, you've told the story of how you used your music video crew, for instance, to go and get footage that otherwise you wouldn't have been able to get. Was it very much like a full-on thinking on your feet kind of shoot?
Oh yeah, I mean the World War II scene is shot by my music video crew. We just come off doing a Boy George video, and so we knew where we get a tank from, and so on a Sunday or weekend we went off with Christoph and my rock and roll crew, and we shot that scene with Nick Rogue's son being the AD and Seppi playing the Nazi, and that sort of guerrilla style actually even worked to a certain degree on main unit, you know, like when he's in the lock and he gets thrown overboard. We didn't have time to shoot him like as a service drowning. So on a Sunday, just Cameron and me and Christoph run down to the lock, and Christoph jumps in the water and does like, "Oh, I'm drowning," and on a day off. So I think everyone was so into the film, they joined the ride, so to speak, you know.
The opening 15, 20 minutes of the film in particular, I dread to think what the studio notes you'd get now would be on that, because the level of trust you've got in the audience to follow the story feels very unconventional, just because you were talking about the transitions and how we're instantly going from one place to another and you leave it to us to work out.
Right.
Was it always so in the edit? Was there a bit of a push and pull that do we need to explain that or just double down on that a little more?
No, there was no, because in the end it was just me and Peter and the two producers, Peter Davison and Bill Panzer. There was no studio involvement at that point. And the only involvement was I think the producers felt the film was a little long. And I remember one classic Monday. The Bill came into the edit and said, "I've just worked out how we can lose 6 minutes in the movie. You cut the one frame in between the cuts, so you cut the end of frame and the first frame of each cut of each scene, and that will add up to 5 minutes." And Peter Holness turned to him, and I said, "Peter, no, don't." Peter was about to sort of rip his throat out. I think he was like, "I mean, so you're telling the editor to lose two frames in every cut, and you don't think he's been very specific where he's cutting?" It's like, it was such an insult, but it was like, God bless him, yeah. But then when we did the first initial screening over at Fox Stages here in LA, they did a screening for execs and whatever, and I remember I was in the toilet at the end, and I heard the voiceovers of various execs saying, "The World War II scene, we'll ditch that. And the scene in France, that it's not funny. Let's get rid of that too." And they wanted to film. It was like maybe 1 hour 20. You know, it was like whatever. And that was like, oh shit, we're in trouble. And they did cut out the World War II scene in the American version. And that's probably one of the reasons why the film didn't do well in the States when it first came out, because without the World War II scene, the film makes, or at least the relationship he has with Brenda, it makes that relationship completely nonsensical.
Yeah.
It actually becomes a little pervy. Like, why is he sort of so attached to this woman?
In terms of taxing things to shoot, just in terms of the time scale and the pressures you were up against, I just wonder if the wrestling at the start is up there, just because, is it right you had less than an hour to actually capture the material you needed?
Oh no, we had 15 minutes.
That's less than an hour. I
Yeah,
could get.
no. It was like it was a real match going on, and then we had 15 minutes where we could put our actor wrestlers in there, and we had two cameras down there filming that, and then we had that Skycam camera on the wires spinning around up to Chris,
Yeah.
and then all the close-ups were done somewhere else. But no, that was it. But we had 15 minutes to do that. I'd film concerts and things, so I was very used to that sort of pressure of doing that. I've done things like that before, where you're allowed to insert your person into a real concert for
Yeah.
10 minutes, and then so that was pretty standard. But there were scenes in a few scenes in that film that were very nervous to film. I mean, the Silver Cup sign at the end
Yeah.
Was nerve-wracking. The collapse of that sign,
Yeah.
because it was built on in a warehouse in London, and two-thirds of that sign is plastic, held up by string. And Alan Cameron, brilliant production designer, designed this thing so only the left-hand side, a small bit, is metal where the actors could stand. The rest is just plastic hanging by string with letters. The neon letters which are held together with their power cords. So when it's going to collapse, we had like 10 cameras, one take, cameras running high speed, and they're calling cameras one, two, three, four, five, six, thinking, oh my God, the cameras one's got run out of film. And then it was like, all cameras ready, go. And so there's guys up on the rafters with scissors going, snip, 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 and the sign collapses. The letters detach. No, the letters start falling, but they're still connected to their electricity.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the water's flooding below, and just before the electric letters, neon letters hit the water, they disconnect, so they cut off their power, so they don't electrocute anyone. One take could never be done again because the set destroyed itself. And so that was probably the most nerve-wracking afternoon.
I put to you, Russell McKay, that if I time traveled to you on that day with your film being held together with string and sellotape, and told you that in 40 years it would be lavishly restored and be getting IMAX anniversary screenings, you'd have called me a madman.
I wasn't even sure I'd last 40 years, let alone the film. The film's done quite well, I mean, the film somehow has found its legs. It refuses to die. And thank you to the audience. I can only thank,
Well, before our time comes to an end, I do want to touch on the music, but I don't want to
Oh
touch
yeah.
on Queen, because I think you're asked about the Queen side of it quite a lot. But one of my favourite composers for film is Michael Kamen,
Oh my God.
the late, great Michael Kamen. And I
Yes,
just
yes, yes.
wonder if you can give me a story of working with him and how special he was to you.
He's very special. I was a huge fan of Brazil,
Yeah.
and actually Peter Hoeness also edited, my editor edited Brazil. So I was a big fan of Michael, and Michael, I would go to his house many times in the evening. We'd sit and watch scenes, and we had this weird sort of like dialogue between each other, which we sort of fed him. We fed off each other's sort of like slight insanity.
Yeah.
And I remember like the car park scene, how we just wanted to make it sort of surreal and bizarre and this and clashing, and he just did that. But then when we had Queen, because of Michael's rock and roll background, he and Queen just got together like a house on fire. So for example, when they did Who Wants to Live Forever, Michael's orchestration just blended in and married to their music so well. He uh, He just embodied that movie so well, and to the point he followed the visuals too. I mean, the sword fight in the blue room, basically kicked the Luma crane across the floor, and the camera spinning across the floor as they're battling and fighting. His music waits for that moment before the camera moves, and then swells on that camera move, and it just his music embodies and helps the visuals so much, and and also help he embodies the romance of the movie, because the film is really a love story through time, and his music really encapsulates that.
And 40 years on, you clearly feel quite emotional when talking about Michael Kamen's work on him.
Yeah, I love Michael. He was a beautiful, beautiful man.
Well, a very happy 40th birthday to Highlander, and immense thanks to you, Russell Mulcahy, for spending time with us on Studio Canal Presents. Thank you so much.
Thank you, thank you.
A brand new collector's 4K UHD and Blu-ray of Highlander is available from the 29th of June 2026. Just got time for our usual roundup of the latest goings-on in the world of Studio Canal. John Schlesinger's classic Billy Liar, one of the most acclaimed films of the 1960s, is arriving on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray disc in a collector's edition. It includes a 64-page booklet and some brand new extra features as well, and the new release is available from the 3rd of August. Another 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray debut to tell you about. On the Cult Classics label this time comes Walter Hill's Johnny Hansen. It's from 1989, sees Mickey Rourke playing a one-time criminal, wouldn't you know it, dragged back to a life of crime. Again, packed with extra features. The disc comes with a 12-page booklet as well, and it will be on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray and standard Blu-ray as well from the 17th of August 2026. Finally, you might have seen the news that a further big screen adventure for our favourite bear, Paddington, is on the way. The fourth film has been written by Simon Blackwell and Armando Iannucci, it's now been revealed. Now, we're still some way away from Paddington 4 going into production, but in the meantime, might I recommend the first three films which are available to watch now. Get some marmalade sandwiches in as well. And that brings us to the end of this episode. I'll be back soon with the next instalment of Studio Canal Presents. Until the next time, to get all the news on Studio Canal films as it happens and to find out more about the Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Instagram and TikTok. Until the next time, I haven't said it yet, there can be only one. Ta-ta for now.